and you're listening to WHPC in Garden City, 9.3 on your dial.
A nice Wednesday in October, 5 p.m., time for American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales-Ryan, here as well.
Always by your side.
For the next hour. Well, you are always by my side, but you're by my side on the radio, for sure, for the next hour. And we do this Wednesdays and Fridays from 5 until 6 p.m., the show on Wednesdays. We started a theme a few months back, which we are calling the Alternative Top 40, or the best albums to never make the top 40, is another way of looking at it. And today is what is probably going to be one of the most difficult albums on the entire list.
Really?
To get through. It's an album that I just really, it took me decades to appreciate. I didn't even really know it in the 60s when it came out. And then by the time I did hear it for the first time, and I'd say, I think it was about the mid 80s when they were all re-released and I bought all the re-releases. Okay. I thought that this album was stunningly unbearable to listen to.
Wow. Interesting challenge that you're putting people to then.
The album is by the Velvet Underground. It's their second album called White Light, White Heat. Now, like I said, when it came out in the 60s, like everybody else, I really didn't, not only did I not buy it, I really didn't know what it was. It was released in January of 1968, their second album, sold very poorly. Only over a matter of time, of course, did the legacy of Velvet Underground just seem to grow in such leaps and bounds that by the time the 80s rolled around, they were considered to be one of the, if not the single most influential band to ever come out of the United States of America, which is just amazing when you look back at it to think about, see how that could have happened from a band that was releasing obscure albums. And even more amazing when you realize that they were releasing albums like this album, White Light, White Heat was the name of it. There's just very little about this album. It's a 40-minute long album, and I would say that about 4 minutes of it are basically aimed at please the listener. The other 36 minutes are there to grate you, to drive you crazy, to make you just, you know, just react. And that's a tough thing. I know, I played this. These albums were re-released, as I said, I think it was like maybe the late 80s. They released them. I bought them all on vinyl when they were re-released. And that was my first time to really hear all of the Velvet Underground albums. Yes, I was very late coming to the party. I was 2 decades late, in fact. But
is that fashionably late by music standards?
Probably not. No, because I, like I said, I mean, they were being re-released because it was widely understood that these albums were, you know, stone classics, every single one of them, and that every single one of them was getting 5-star reviews. 5 star out of 5.
Just not by you.
Well, I got the first album pretty quickly. Enjoyed it. Got the third album even more because it was just a more pleasant listen even than the first album. The second album, I just couldn't get it into my what I call my basement list fast enough. Which is I'll play it and just realize I can't listen to this. I really, you know, which means that
it's, rarely happens with you.
And when that does happen, it means I'm going to have to play the album one more time to give it a final chance. And then if I still don't like it, I literally put it in the basement. I just put it away. Like, okay, that's like where the stuff I don't think I'm going to need to listen to anymore is what's down there.
The ones that make your ears bleed.
I was the one. I went back to this album. You could just tell it was bothering me because I kept going back about at least once a year to see if I would like it. And for about the next 15 years, the answer remained no. So, you know, I'm not kidding. Really, up until maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when I really started to analyze, especially with this alternative top 40 thing, I began to realize what this album is sort of about. And I tip my hat to it. It doesn't mean I love it, but it means that it is absolutely, it stands for something that nobody else had the guts to do in 1968. And it had a huge amount of influence subsequently. So let's play the first track on side one, which happens to be the title track. No doubt, a song whose like incredibly aggressive rhythms had an awful lot to do with the birthing of punk rock in about maybe 6 or 7 years hence from when this was released. The whole point of the song is more or less to replicate what it feels like if you shoot methamphetamine into your veins. The beat, the rhythm, the intensity, especially the pounding bass at the end, meant to sound like what would be happening in your skull if you had taken this drug in this form. It just sets up the album. And by the way, this is 3 out of the 4 pleasant minutes on the record. Here's White Light, White Heat. White light, red light going, this is the prime light. Well, don't you know I'm gonna make me go blind. Oh, white heat, it tickled me down to my toes. Oh, helpless it, white light have it through the nose. White light going, this is for my dream. Oh, white light is gonna drive me insane. Oh, white heat, it tickled me down to my toes. Oh, white light, I said now. I truly do love watch that stuff dip itself in. Watch that side, no one's still gonna be dead and right. Bad foxy mama walking, walking down the street. From outside your head gonna make a dead ain't on your street. See what I mean? Starts out pleasant, ends up on the total crazy noise rush.
Yeah, but I like that.
That is the fun song. A song about basically shooting up methamphetamine. We just got a call from a real regular listener, calls up the station often, John Freeport. And he makes a valid point. He goes like, you know, if you have to listen to an album that many times to begin to appreciate it, at what point do you just give up? So, you know, maybe it's just the repetition at some point.
Kind of like drinking bourbon.
Maybe that's what it is like.
I don't like bourbon.
Maybe that's exactly what it's like. I mean, just because you don't like it the first time, means you come back to it, it might be pretty awesome. And I'm finding I mean, of course, this album has been on something like everybody's best album of all time list, it seems. If not, like in the top 100. I mean, Rolling Stone's top 500 had it rated very high. And I could go through this list and I'll come up with a dozen others. Now, I don't want to say that I'm a sucker and I have to basically like just what everybody else likes. But playing this album in its chronological place is what really began to push me over the edge toward liking it. You know, hearing it in 1988 with its 1968 sound and it's noisy and it's just cacophonous, it really was just difficult. But playing it in the context of January 1968, I mean, this is really like, you want to know like when the Summer of Love ended? It ended on side one of White Light, White Heat. That's just more or less a fact.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You
know? This just said there's no Summer of Love at all. And then if you
That's East Coast versus West Coast, too. I mean,
it's all of that. It's 1968 versus 1967. I mean, 68 is when things begin to get heavy and dark after all the lightness and the, you know, when the psychedelic stuff began to turn and the drugs got uglier and the mood got uglier and it wasn't just, you know, flower power. It was basically revolution in the streets in Kent State and people dead and getting shot. And this album is more or less the first salvo that got shot off and says, no, we're not that anymore. Like this next track that we're going to play on the album, it's over 8 minutes long, and it's essentially an instrumental on one channel. You're going to hear nothing but the band on one side, and on the other side, you hear John Cale reading a short story about somebody named Waldo Jeffers, who is basically upset about being separated from his college girlfriend, Marcia, and how he basically concocts a plan to mail himself to her.
Oh, nice.
And he's sent through the mail, and the story unfolds with Marcia and her friend getting the box and trying to figure out how to open it. I'm not going to go any more than that because, if you want to hear the story, you might be interested in playing with your balance button if you have one, so you could hear the story all on one side and eliminate the cacophonous music on the other. Or if you really don't want to hear the story, do the opposite. This is called...
Technology, kids.
That's if we're broadcasting in stereo now. I believe we are. We usually are, but sometimes the transmitter messes us up and does otherwise. But that being the case, do what you wish. This track is called The Gift. See you in about 8 minutes.
Waldo Jeffers had reached his limit. It was now mid-August. Jumenti had been separated from Marcia for more than 2 months. 2 months, and all he had to show were three dog-eared letters and two very expensive long-distance phone calls. True, when school had ended and she'd returned to Wisconsin, he to Locust, Pennsylvania, she had sworn to maintain a certain fidelity. She would date occasionally, but merely as amusement. She would remain faithful. But lately, Waldo had begun to worry. He'd had trouble sleeping at nights, and when he did, he had horrible dreams. He lay awake at night, tossing and turning underneath his pleated quilt protector, tears welling in his eyes as he pictured Marcia, her sworn vows overcome by liquor and the smooth soothings of some Neanderthal, finally submitting to the final caresses of sexual oblivion. It was more than the human mind could bear. Visions of Marcia's faithlessness haunted him. Daytime fantasies of sexual abandon permeated his thoughts. And the thing was, they wouldn't understand how she really was. He, Waldo, alone understood this. He had intuitively grasped every nook and cranny of her psyche. He'd made her smile. She needed him. He wasn't there. The idea came to him on the Thursday before the Mama's Parade was scheduled to appear. He just finished mowing and edging the Adelson's lawn for $1.50, and I checked the mailbox to see if there was an Easter word in Marshall. There was nothing but a circular from the Amalgamated Union Company of America inquiring into his own needs. At least they cared enough to write. It was a New York company. You could go anywhere in the mails. Then it struck him. He didn't have enough money to go to Wisconsin in the accepted fashion, true. But why not mail himself? It was absurd. he would ship himself parcel post special delivery. The next day, Waldo went to the supermarket to purchase the necessary equipment. He brought masking tape, a staple gun, and a medium-sized cardboard box just right for a person of his build. He judged that with a minimum of jostling, he could ride quite comfortably. A few air holes, some water, a personal night snacks, and it would probably be as good as going tourist. By Friday afternoon, Waldo was set. He was thoroughly packed, and the post office had agreed to pick him up at 3 o'clock. He'd marked the package fragile, and as he sat curled up inside, resting on a foam rubber cushioning he thoughtfully favored, he tried to picture the look of awe and happiness on Marcia's face as she opened the door, saw the package, tipped the deliverer, and then opened it to see her Waldo finally there in person. She would kiss him, and then maybe they could see a movie. If he'd only thought of this before. Suddenly, rough hands gripped his package, and he felt himself borne up. He landed with a thud in the truck and was off. Marcia Bronson had just finished setting her hair. It had been a very rough weekend. She had to remember not to drink like that. Bill had been nice about it, though. After it was over, he said he still respected her, and after all, it was certainly the way of nature. And even though, no, he didn't love her, he did feel an affection for her. And after all, they were grown adults. Oh, and Bill could teach Waldo. But that seemed many years ago. Sheila Klein, her very, very best friend, walked in through the porch screen door and into the kitchen. Oh God, it's absolutely maudlin outside. Ah, I know what you mean. I feel all icky. Marcia tightened the belt on her cotton robe with the silk outer edge. Sheila ran her finger over some salt grains on the kitchen table, licked her finger and made a face. I'm supposed to be taking these salt pills, but she winked her nose. They make me feel like throwing up. Marcia started to pat herself on the gym, an exercise she'd seen on television. God, don't even talk about that. She got up from the table and went to the sink where she picked up a bottle of pink and blue vitamins. Want one? Supposed to be better than steak. And then attempted to touch her nose. I don't think I'll ever touch a daiquiri again. She gave up and sat down, this time near the small table that supported the telephone. Maybe Bill will call, she said to Sheila's glass. Sheila nibbled on the cubicle. After last night, I thought maybe you'd be through with him. I know what you mean. My God, he's like an octopus, hands all over the place. She gestured, raising her arms upward in defense. The thing is, after a while, you get tired of fighting with him, you know. And after all, I didn't really do anything Friday and Saturday, so I kind of owed it to him. You know what I mean. She started to scratch. Sheila was giggling with her hand over her mouth. I tell you, I felt the same way. And even after a while, she bent forward and whispered, I wanted to. Now she was laughing very loudly. It was at this point that Mr. Jameson of the Clarence Darrow Post Office rang the doorbell of the large sticker-covered frame house. When Marcia Bronson opened the door, he helped her carry the package in. He had his yellow and his green slips of paper signed and left with a 15-cent tip that Marcia had gotten out of her mother's small beige pocketbook in the den. What do you think it is? Sheila asked. Marcia stood with her arms folded behind her back. She stared at the brown cardboard carton that sat in the middle of the room. I don't know. Inside the package, Waldo quivered with excitement as he listened to the voices. Sheila ran her fingernail over the masking tape that ran down the center of the carton. Why don't you look at the return address and see who it's from? Waldo felt his heart beating. He could feel the vibrating footsteps. Marcia walked around the carton and read the ink-scratched label. Oh, God, it's from Waldo! That schmuck, said Sheila. Waldo trembled with expectation. Well, you might as well open it, said Sheila. Both of them tried to lift the staple flap. Said Marcia. He must have nailed it shut. They tugged on the flap again. My God, you need a power drill to get this thing open. Can't get a grip. They both stood still, breathing heavily. Why don't you get a scissor, said Sheila. Marcia ran into the kitchen, but all she could find was a little sewing scissor. Then she remembered that her father kept a collection of tools in the basement. She ran downstairs, and when she came back up, she had a large sheet metal cutter in her hand. This is the best I could find, she told her friend. Here, you do it. I'm gonna die. She sank into a large fluffy couch and exhaled noisily. Sheila tried to make a slit between the masking tape and the end of the cardboard flap, but the blade was too big and there wasn't enough room. God damn this thing, she said, feeling very exasperated. Then smiling, I got an idea. What, said Roger. Just watch, said Sheila, touching her finger to her head. Inside the package, Waldo was so transfixed with excitement that he barely breathed. His skin fell quickly from the heat, and he could feel his heart beating in his throat. It would be soon. Sheila stood quite upright and walked around to the other side of the package. Then she sank down to her knees, grasped the cutter by both handles, took a deep breath, and plunged the long blade through the middle of the package, through the masking tape, through the cardboard, through the cushioning, and right through the center of Waldo Jeffers' head, which split slightly and caused little rhythmic arcs of red to pulsate gently in the morning sun.
Oh, I remember listening to that in high school.
The funny, I mean, that's a story that was written by Lou Reed in college for a project or something. And John Cale, I guess, got a hold of it. John Cale is reading it while the band is playing that basically one chord jam that's going on the other channel. It's just, it sets up the avant-garde nature of this album for what it is. I mean, anybody thought that the first album was avant-garde, which in a sense it was. It was very, if it was diverse, if nothing else. But it, that, you know, this track makes Heroin sound like a fairy tale. It's just crazy. And the next track takes it to another level. The next track is, well, you could, it depends how you interpret the lyrics, but essentially it seems to be about probably a transsexual who is having some sort of an operation. Some people interpret that it's a lobotomy and things go wrong during the operation. So it's, again, it's more of, you know, cuts and just, you know, things that are just miserable to listen to.
We have to think that they're hanging out with Andy Warhol. He's making all kinds of avant-garde movies too during this time.
Yes.
Like Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, for instance.
I mean, good
it's
point.
All of a generation of New York art students, you know.
There was a sense of, like, can you top this, probably.
Yes.
And but nobody else had a recording contract that would have allowed this to happen. You know what I mean? But because of their association, and now the fact that they also they don't have Nico anymore. Nico was with them on the first album, who added a very Germanic, you know, sense of
melancholy.
Yeah, but there was melancholy there with the stridency. With that gone now, the four remaining members are just free to totally dive in and go deep on whatever their craziest thoughts are. So, you know, the gift sets it up. Well, now they do it with lyrics. The name of this song, actually, it starts really with a verse about Lady Godiva. And it's called Lady Godiva's Operation. So I guess what it is it's setting up, like, okay, is Lady Godiva the Lady Godiva, or is it Lady Godiva somebody who might be a transsexual who people refer to as Lady Godiva, who is now undergoing an operation, perhaps a sex change or a lobotomy? It could be either, I think. I mean, there might be a lyric in there that gives it away.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
But here's the third track on the song that ends side one, called Lady Godiva's Operation.
Lady Godiva dressed so demurely at the head of another curly-haired boy, just another toy. Sick with silence, she weeps sincerely, saying words that have oh so clearly been said so long ago. Thank you. arm gently round her shoulder. Life has made her that much bolder now that she found out how. Dressed in silk, Latin lace and envy, pride and joy of the latest penny fair, pretty passing care. Hair today now dipped in the water, making love to every poor daughter's son. Isn't it fun? Today propping grace within me, Lady Godiva appears to see if anyone's there and hasn't a care. Doctor is coming, the nurse thinks
sweetly,
turning on the machines that
neatly pump air.
The body lies bare, hairless, what once was
screaming
now lies silent and
almost sleeping.
The brain must have gone away.
Strapped securely to the white table, beneath the cords, the body to wither and ride
underneath the white fly.
Doctor rides, knife and baggage, sees the growth is just so much cabbage.
Oh,
that must now be cut away.
Now comes the moment of great, great decision. Doctor is making his first incision.
One goes here.
One goes there.
Beneath the tears leaking, says someone who's sloppy.
Patient, it seems, is not so well sleeping.
Screams echo on the wall. Don't panic, someone give him pentothal and spooky. Doctor removes his blade, cagily so from the brain.
By my count of ten,
my head won't move.
This song is like a slow nightmare.
It is. It's someone that didn't, the anesthesia didn't work on.
Right, right. Lou Reed's interjections are so weird because you hear, like, you know, there's John Cale again who's doing most of the vocalizing, sticking to the melody, but then Lou Reed throws in a word or two here that just sounds like disturbed, almost unrelated to what John Cale is doing. And then
well,
there's that.
It's supposed to be like emphasizing the emotion of the person that's on the table that can't really speak.
Right, to give you the feel of the jumping.
Yes.
Or the shock of what is happening,
right?
Who can't react. And that weird purring noise that's going on in the background. I don't know what to make out of that either. Incredible.
You just can't handle it because it reminds you of that song that you used to make you ill when you were a kid. They're coming to take you away.
No, that's still, I think I'm over that. But that song, that's another story. But that's another story altogether. Boy, when I was a little kid, this song literally made me throw up. Twice. So I know it was genuinely the song. I know it because I played it as a challenge to myself the second time to see if that would really happen. And right there at the table.
Oh, no.
Oops. I was a sensitive little kid. What can I say?
And you still are. That's my point.
This is a bit more arty, so I guess it's not as direct as that song. But it's when things play with pitch is what gives me a bit of like a nightmare sense. When things aren't tuneful and they start to like waver,
mm-hmm.
so that the pitch begins to seem as though it's like not normal, like
yeah,
a record running
out of... Yeah,
it gives
you like a queasy, uneasy feeling.
Yeah, yeah. There's a little bit of that on Lady Godiva's Operation. It just kind of messes with my head. Now, this next track is maybe the other 2 minutes that I said of, like, you know, basically stuff that's like at least reasonably listenable. It's the song's only 2 minutes long. It's funny because it was released as the B-side on a single to White Light, White Heat as the A-side, which is kind of funny if you think of that as a 45. Like, really? You know, you're thinking that was going to get airplay in the United States of America in 1968?
Well.
Stuns me.
Gotta try.
The song was originally meant for Nico to sing. In fact, when she was in the band, they used to do this song. She would sing it live. She's out of the band now, so it was recorded again with the band themselves recording it without Nico and Lou Reed doing the singing. It's called Here She Comes Now. It's almost like a brief respite.
You got some relief.
With that song.
Poor you.
Here She Comes Now. No, I'm not kidding. I'm probably enjoying this album more now than I've ever enjoyed it, because to be able to sit around and actually have, you know, with other people calling in and you listening and all of us, you know, sitting here together and listening to it, I'm actually finding that it's genuinely interesting and kind of fun in its own weird way. Now, the next track... The fifth track, there's only six songs on the album. Track five is called I Heard Her Call My Name. And Sterling Morrison, the other guitar player in the band,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the band is essentially four people. Lou Reed, John Cale, Sterling Morrison, and Maureen Tucker on drums. One of the things that always held me back from really appreciating the band was Maureen Tucker on percussion, because she's just so primitive in her drum style that... It really unnerved me as a drummer. I'm just like, come on, really? She's just going to basically bang on that thing, eighth notes, you know, with mallets. And, you know, now I hear it, I'm like, what's my problem? It's totally cool for what it is. Let it be. If I was going to basically be a drummer on this stuff, I totally would have ruined every track, because I would have been trying to be conventional. It's the unconventional aspect of it that makes it overall work. If there was anything at all conventional about the music, how could the album possibly be, you know, I know it wouldn't have been as important and as innovative as it is. So tip of the hat to Mo Tucker now, and I apologize for having it cause me to take 20 years to figure it out. That being said, though, Sterling Morrison, about this next track, I heard a caller name. Here's his quote. I quit the group for a couple of days because I thought they chose the wrong mix for this song. One of our best songs that was completely ruined in the studio. Apparently, Lou Reed and John Cale got really excited to see how atonal they could make their guitar sound. And figuring that the worse they could make it sound, the better it was ultimately going to be for the track.
Interesting.
And that's what caused the rift and eventually made Sterling Morrison want to quit. You'll hear those solos on this track called I Heard Her Call My Name.
Got my eyes wide open. It's just a was on people Monday. Got my eyeballs on my knees. I take a walk. I rap for hours with Mad Mary Williams. Says she never understood a word from me because I know that you cares about me. I couldn't call my name. Mind split over.
my God.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. I heard her call my name. Now we're just getting warmed up. Because
yeah,
now
baby.
It's time for the album closer, which is over 17 minutes in length. Here's Lou Reed's description. Well, actually, let me read my review of the album, and then we'll let Lou Reed get the last word in. January 1968, this album reached number 199 on the Billboard charts. That's as high as it ever got. But it did get on the Billboard charts, which is amazing, at number 199. This is probably the most difficult album to like on this on my entire list of 500.
Man, and I love it.
Easy to appreciate, but extremely difficult to enjoy. Only three tracks, the three shortest, could even qualify rightly as songs, and even they'll descend into a sea of atonal noise. The rest are relentless studies and mind-numbing, nerve-rattling cacophony. Gone is Nico, the stoic, Germanic voice of reason. Andy Warhol could have proven to be a stabilizing influence, if you could even imagine that that is possible. But the band left his employ. Completely absent is anything even resembling the genteel appeal of Sunday morning. Instead, we have horrific tales of drug-addled orgies, lobotomies, and accidental murder, subjects more appropriate for an emergency room than for a backyard barbecue. What's even more disturbing is that the music brilliantly fits with the subject matter. Playing the entire album in one sitting is like experiencing a 40-minute car accident. It's an album that leaves you feeling slightly ill with frayed nerves, whether you pay attention or not. If you play this album often, you probably don't have many friends. I've heard numerous critics complain about Lou Reed's solo atrocity, Metal Machine Music, but few ever discuss the painful abrasions, probably rug burns, caused by Sister Ray, which we're about to play. If you don't believe me, put it to the test. I guarantee that you will not be allowed to play the entire 17 and a half minutes in a public environment, which I'm about
to.
Hell, this song would even ruin your orgy, which may be why it's so easy to appreciate. If every band made music like this, I'd likely be dead by now. Thank God the Velvet Underground did it in 1968, and now anybody who tries to do something this unbearably painful is just copying the idea. Noise like this can be original only once. Here it is. Here's Lou Reed's take on it now. Sister Ray, I wrote that as a joke. No, not as a joke, but it has eight characters in it, and this guy gets killed and nobody does anything. It was built around the story that I wrote about this scene of total debauchery and decay. I like to think of Sister Ray as a transvestite smack dealer. The situation is a bunch of drag queens taking some sailors home with them, shooting up on smack, and then having this orgy when the police appear.
Oops.
Enjoy this, everybody. We'll see you Friday.
Looking for the downfight. Who's standing at this way on? Who's busy licking up the big man? I'm searching for my main line. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. I just like Sister Ray said, whipping on. Who just got back from Carolina? She said she didn't like the weather. They're busy waiting for her sailor. Who's living just a bigger liver? He says, give him Alabama. He wants no way to earn a dollar. I'm searching for my meaner. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. I couldn't hit it sideways. Oh, just like Sister Ray said. you'll stain the carpet. Now don't you know you'll stain the carpet. And by the way, it's got a dollar. Oh no, man, I haven't got the time. Too busy sucking on a ding-dong. Busy sucking on my ding-dong. Oh, she does that just to raise it. good. Take it up, take it. Good on our main line. I couldn't hit it sideways. I couldn't hit it sideways. Just like, oh, just like, good. Just like. Rosie and the crayon, they're busy waiting for her booster. She's just back from Carolina. She says she's bound to beat a sailor. I says you haven't got the time. You're busy sucking on my ding dong. You're busy sucking on my ding dong. Now just like Sister Reese, I'm searching for my main line. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. Whip it on the gym, whip it on the gym, whip it on the gym, whip it on the gym. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. Oh, do it. Now just like Sister Ray said. I said now Cecil's got his new piece. He cocks and shoots and bang between 3 and 4. It at the sailor, he shoots him down dead on the floor. Oh, you shouldn't do that. Don't you know you'll hit the carpet? Don't you know you'll mess the carpet? Got the time. This is sucking on the ding dong. This is sucking on the ding dong. Now just like Sister Ray said, said I couldn't hit it sideways. I said I couldn't hit it sideways. That's just right. That's just right. Wait a minute.